Welcome to the Jeffers Brief, only on Contra Radio Network.
And welcome to the Jeffers Brief. I'm John Jeffers, your host, founder, executive producer here at CRN. Glad to have you here. Yes, yes, yes. First things first, tonight we have our premiere of a new show here on the Contra Radio Network here on CRN with, well, it's called The Conservative Underground. Your host is Donald Lowry. I want you to give his show a listen. I think you'll like it. I think you'll like what Don has to say. He's also known as Big D. Obviously, you know, first name's Donald Big D. Got it? Okay. Yes, welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are glad to have them here on CRN. Okay, today, depends on when you're listening to the show, got a lot to talk about, a lot, and I'm not sure we're going to get to everything, but we're going to try. In case you haven't noticed, the Bruce Orr revelations that are coming out now. What do we got queued up? Lou Dobbs? Okay. We got Lou Dobbs queued up for about 6 minutes here. He's going to explain it to him. He's talking to Victor Tensing and Joe DeGenova, both former federal prosecutors. So, what we found out today, this bombshell, is that Bruce Orr shared information from the dossier author in 2016 with DOJ prosecutors who are now working for Special Counsel Robert Mueller. So, it's about 6 minutes, 10 seconds. Go ahead and listen in on this. I want you to be aware of what's happening. Bombshell has just been released. Here you go.
Joining us now to take up the revelation that the Justice Department official, Bruce Orr, shared that information about the discredited dossier with the FBI's Andrew Weissman and others. At the time, Weissman was the head of the fraud section. Now he's a senior member of the special counsel's office, or witch hunt, if you prefer. Victoria Tensing, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of Justice, and Joe DeGenova, former U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, founding partners of the firm DeGenova and Tensing. Good to have you both with us. And let's start with this. We sort of had an indication of this throughout. But this revelation now is raising all sorts of questions. One is, it seems designed in part, at least to me, to make Orr look better, but it certainly is damning to the top officials of the FBI. Your thoughts? Let's begin with you, Victoria.
Well, he only looks slightly better, Lou, because I think he is protecting Sally Yates. He was Sally Yates' deputy, and yet he claims that he never said this to Sally Yates. This needs to go to a grand jury where Bruce Orr and Sally Yates are both brought in to say whether he told her or not. And then, for those of us who know the Justice Department, it's odd, and John Solomon's such a good reporter. His facts are accurate, but here's what's wrong at the Justice Department.
John Solomon reporting for The Hill.
This is his story. I was Deputy Assistant Attorney General. I did not brief section chiefs and line attorneys. They are not senior Justice Department officials. Those kinds of people briefed me. So why is Orr briefing people lower on the totem pole than he? And here's what else is wrong. He's briefing Andrew Weissman. Andrew Weissman's the head of the fraud section, as you just reported. I supervised the fraud section. It has nothing to do with FISA applications. So what was he doing there, unless he was a Clintonista, to find out all kinds of things? There's
not
something
a part,
very
not a part
strange.
Of what would be a counter espionage or counterintelligence right. operation or in any way associated with the National Security Division.
Out of his portfolio. Right. Completely. So more than the Congress lying about what was said, That's more of the story.
This is a story, Joe, as we all know, that goes on and on. And with the names that have been fired and transferred and demoted and, on and on, the list goes at the top of the Justice Department, but primarily at the department, the FBI. There's no prosecution. There's nothing happening here. This is an entire deep state, it seems, at least to most of us observing from a distance, that is purely to run out the clock and to deny justice, not to bring anyone to justice.
Well, I think that's all going to change when Bill Barr becomes the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. I expect him to authorize grand juries into all of this if they're not already being to conduct it, and to make them robust if they are not robust now, and to replace people who are not doing their jobs, including Mr. Huber. What's fascinating about the Orr testimony is that he now establishes as a fact that the FBI was told before the first application for a FISA warrant that the information was unverified, unreliable, and that Christopher Steele had an animus toward the President of the United States, and that they needed to be careful. And we know that they were not careful. What he has done through his testimony is established that there was a cabal, that the FBI senior officials and senior DOJ officials wanted to get Donald Trump regardless of the evidence, and they wanted to spy on him, and they succeeded in doing so by lying to a FISA court, which has now been established, and committing federal felonies in doing so. I expect Attorney General Barr, when he is confirmed, to impanel a grand jury to investigate all of this.
Do you, let's get your opinion on this. William Barr, a man with a reputation for integrity and effectiveness, do you think he understands that this is a time in which the FBI has zero credibility with the American public, zero regard for the integrity, and I'm talking about from field agents through the top officials, unfairly in some cases, but for the top leadership of the FBI, the Department of Justice, it is a quagmire of corruption.
I think he knows that the Department of Justice and the FBI, its most important component, are at an historic low in public respect and esteem. He knows that the senior people of the Obama DOJ and FBI have destroyed an institution for two reasons: to protect Hillary Clinton and to destroy Donald Trump and to destroy his presidency. This is, in fact, the greatest political scandal in the history of our country. And I expect Bill Barr to do what he has always done. He will enforce the law equally, but he will also ensure that the DOJ and the FBI are rooted out of people who have subverted the rule of law.
And let me tell you what else Bill has. He has a love of the law. And those of us who've been at the Justice Department feel the same.
I hope we have somebody that has a love for this country and for the American people.
But that is the love for the law, Lou.
They have been. This is just stomach churning to look at the level of corruption.
It is.
And those of us who love the law are just so upset about what is happening, and Bill Barr is one of them.
All right.
And he will do a fine job.
All right.
Well, there you have it. That was Lou Dobbs on the Fox Business Network, which, by the way, I do watch daily. I don't watch Fox News. I watch Fox Business News. I just do. Maybe because I have investments, and I like listening especially to Varney in the morning, Stu Varney. Okay. Now, to talk about John Solomon, Sundance, if you don't know, he gets all this stuff ahead of time. And John Solomon, he's the Hill reporter. Bruce Orr testimony shows politically motivated DOJ and FBI ignored warnings. So, John Solomon, this is what Sundance has written, has a well-written article at the Hill outlining the leaked transcript from Bruce Orr together with his own sources. The key point Solomon focuses upon is how Bruce Orr warned DOJ and FBI officials about the political intents and specifics behind the inbound information from Chris Steele and Fusion GPS. Don't forget Fusion GPS, Glenn Simpson. Yeah. The primary aspect to Orr's testimony is how strongly he warned officials at the FBI, McCabe, Page, Baker, Strzok, and Pienka. and officials in DOJ, Maine Justice Andrew Weissman, who is a... Never mind, I can't say it on the air. Bruce Swartz and Zainab Ahmed about the political intents and purposes behind the information that eventually became the Steele dossier. In essence, Bruce Orr told the FBI and Maine Justice right at the outset of their Crossfire Hurricane operation that Chris Steele's work product was an assembly of political opposition research specifically paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Under all ordinary circumstances, this under oath revelation would be a game changer, particularly because two of those in Maine Justice who knew about the political construct, Ahmed and Weissman, are currently officials directly on the Robert Mueller probe. Let's change probe to witch hunt. However, in the highly partisan era of Trump hate, the media will completely ignore the scale of this admission by Bruce Orr. Additionally, not only did FBI Director McCabe ignore the warnings, but apparently McCabe failed to tell Comey about the nature of Orr's warnings prior to Comey signing off on the FISA application against Carter Page. God, I love it. You know, let's take a quick break here. And my note, my personal note is, I just love it when people who are corrupt sit there and they screw over everybody, and then when they get caught, they try to throw everybody else under the bus until you find out that maybe some of these people didn't know about what they were being told or should have been told and weren't. Get back to it. On the Maine's justice side of the FISA application, Orr's internal warnings did not stop Deputy AG Sally Yates from also signing off on the FISA application that utilized the highly political opposition research turned into an intelligence product. Lastly, this testimony from Orr is evidence that the HPSCI, that's the House Committee on Intelligence, minority memo written by Adam Schiff was entirely false, no kidding, in their framing of the Steele dossier as it was used in the FISA application. You mean Schiff, who is now head of the Intel Committee, lied? Oh no, say it ain't so. The DOJ and FBI were specifically warned the dossier was political opposition research compiled by anti-Trump efforts from Fusion GPS and Chris Steele and paid for by, you've heard it a thousand times, the Hillary Clinton campaign. However, DOJ and FBI chose to use it regardless of sourcing or verification and without informing the FISA court, which, by the way, that should be perjury, just my opinion. I'm sure Glenn Tate could probably have him because he is a practicing attorney. And if you don't listen to Glenn, he's on Prepping 2.0. Again, on CRN right here. CRN. Again, under normal circumstances, this new evidence would fundamentally change the media outlook toward the entire 2+ year narrative, and we could interpret the discovery as a game changer. However, given how thoroughly the media have abdicated any semblance of integrity, unfortunately, it's likely no one in the mainstream media will allow new facts to interrupt their carefully created narrative. So after a year of revelations and expectations that go nowhere, the TikTok Club finally have a key piece of evidence that should start turning the proverbial tide. However, without a specific, direct, formal, and official DOJ-FBI outline, press conferences, etc., drawing national attention to the Bruce Orr revelation, there's also a possibility people who realize the significance are left alone in the woods, shouting at trees. Well, it's true. I mean, after all, we know, well, we shouldn't say I know, but, you know, we see it all. We hear it all. And yet, for those of us out here and, you know, good American citizens, we think, you know, if it was you or I doing this, they would have had us indicted months and months and months ago. But yet nothing ever happens. And we all see the stories on Facebook about so-and-so is going to do this, so-and-so is going to do that, this is coming out. So what? Nothing's happened. And I think that Lou Dobbs is absolutely correct in his piece, or at the end of his piece, when he says they're just trying to run out the clock. Do what they can. Run out the clock. Do anything. You know, slow it down. Don't let it, you know, this happen. So, with that said, there you go. Human events. That's a powerful conservative voices. If you like that kind of a magazine or e-magazine, if you will. Ann Coulter is one of, I like Ann Coulter. Some people don't. I like her. And she put out a pretty good article yesterday. And she titled it, White Supremacists Ate My Homework. And before we get to that, let me get a couple stuff going on here. Hey, look up Gator Gaynor on Facebook. You'll like him. Here.
To all of the podcasters out there who are recording great content shows but are lacking the know-how or the time to edit your episodes into a concise finished product, I'm here to help. Hi, I'm Gator Gaynor, and I've been producing radio shows for a long time, and I've recently stepped into the podcast producing world to assist people just like you. So if you're needing someone to take your recorded audio and make it into a produced package that's ready for distribution, get in touch and let's figure out a plan that works for you. You can hear an example of my work on the Prepping 2.0 podcast, as well as on my SoundCloud page. Just search for Gator Gaynor. That's GatorGaynor. Find me on Facebook and email me at gator.gaynor@gmail.com. That's GATOR.GAYNOR@gmail.com.
This is Contra Radio Network, internet radio for the discerning prepper and patriot.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. All right. I want to get back to it with Ann Coulter here, founded at Human Events. I think you guys will like this. She wrote this yesterday, about 6:30 in the evening. And she writes, by finally returning to the issue that won him the election, President Trump once again has a winning hand. That's why we're hearing so much about, quote-unquote, white supremacy this week. Liberals lie all the time, but when they know they're vulnerable, they lie even more all the time. They're vulnerable on immigration. Even heroic, nonstop lying doesn't help, as CNN has discovered. So naturally, the media have turned to their larger project of relentlessly trying to discredit conservatives as white supremacists. Unfortunately for them, apart from a few crackpots, whom I assume exist in a country of 320 million people, there are no white supremacists. There were white supremacists 50 years ago, and they were all Democrats. You don't believe me? Check out her book, Mugged, Racial Demagoguery from the 70s to Obama. Now today, white supremacy is nothing but a comfortable fantasy the left developed to explain its sick preoccupation with white people. Talk about a manufactured crisis? The same people who love to snicker about Fox News viewers worrying about Sharia law sweeping the country are convinced that mythical white supremacists are hiding under every bed. The whole concept is bogus. In my life, I've encountered a number of white people. Some of them are my best friends. I've never heard any of them suggest that whites should rule over other races. None of them has argued that a substandard white person should get a job over a more competent person just because he's white. You know, what every other group openly advocates for itself. Now, there is a whole swath of journalists who have decided that instead of investigating relevant news, they will spend their time doing oppo research on prominent conservatives, hoping against hope to call them racist. If the facts don't fit, they'll make them up. The New York Times' Maureen Dowd once famously imagined a Republican congressman calling Obama boy. This week, Newsweek's Nina Burley, who said, I'd be happy to give Bill Clinton a BJ just to thank him for keeping abortion legal. She casually asked to interview me about white identity politics. I have nothing to do with white identity politics. I don't know anyone who knows anyone who even knows what that means. Nor do I know anyone who's seen a copy of Newsweek in the last decade. When will we get around to talking about the media's actual hatred of whites? Last year, the New York Times hired Sarah Jeong, a Korean journalist who has posted such venomous anti-white tweets as, white men are BS. F white women, LOL. White people have stopped breeding. You'll all go extinct soon. That was my plan all along. dumbass effing white people marking up the internet with their opinions like dogs urinating on fire hydrants. Hashtag cancel white people. Are white people genetically predisposed to burn faster in the sun, thus logically being only fit to live underground like groveling goblins? Oh man, it's kind of sick how much joy I get of being cruel to old white men. Now there's no question but that such racist attacks would never be tolerated toward any other group. John never apologized and happily took her seat on the New York Times editorial board. Our cultural institutions regard the statement it's okay to be white as hate speech. Colleges instigate investigations whenever signs with that phrase appear on campus. Second graders in this country are being indoctrinated into white privilege ideology. Eventually, people get tired of the left's fixation on white people. The gratuitous dumping on Western civilization, the incessant sneering about old white men, and the nonsense about white privilege, as if every white person knows every other white person and is greased into jobs and promotions. But if you ever respond to the hate by noting that the contributions from the parts of the world loathed by the New York Times dwarf the contributions of other cultures, they threaten you. Any references to white male accomplishments are merely defensive. Consider the current Gillette ad. We believe the best men can be. After the board of directors rejected the more accurate title, announcement to shareholders, we're folding the company. The ad shows only white men harassing women and being corrected by minority men. As long as they brought it up, every culture in the universe is galaxies more misogynistic than Western European culture. The ad should have been titled, "Hey White America, you've got to stop doing the things that everyone but you does." When other groups talk about themselves, they instantly go to, "We rock, we're awesome." Only the descendants of white Western Europeans are not allowed to be proud of their culture. There is still casual racism, and that should be quickly and severely condemned. Iowa Representative Steve King, for example, was fanatically obsessed with vindicating a white defendant accused of first murdering a half-Pakistani woman, and second, falsely accusing a Congolese man of the murder. Except King never did that. Newsweek's Burley did, write an entire book in defense of alabaster white Amanda Knox after she was convicted of the brutal murder of her half-Pakistani roommate, later overturned, and also convicted of falsely accusing an innocent Congolese man of the crime for which she served 4 years. Liberals could never in a million years survive the standards of racism applied to conservatives. Even famed defense attorney Alan Dershowitz said that the only reason journalists defended Foxy Noxy was that she's pretty and she doesn't look like she did it, and Americans care about what people look like. She's the all-American young woman, and we don't care about the evidence. If you want to know about white supremacy, Nina, interview yourself, and after that, maybe you can learn your maid's name. But let's get back to the subject you desperately don't want to discuss, how uncontrolled, low-skilled immigration is slaughtering our working class. White, black, and brown. Is she right? Now, where did we find this one? Now, the American Spectator, another great conservative magazine, had this one put out by R. Emmett Tyrrell Jr. And this was put out yesterday. And it's entitled, "The Current Crisis, The Democrats' Blueprint for Impeachment." I know. The charge? Joking in public? Do you recall back in July of 2016 when candidate Donald J. Trump brought down the House at a campaign press conference in Miami by jokingly pleading with the Russians to hack into Hillary Clinton's emails? Bill's wife, Bruno, as we call her, was claiming that she had lost some 30,000 emails, and so Donald Trump got a laugh by saying, "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing." At least he got a laugh from the civilized minority who were following him. Apparently, we of the civilized minority were contributing to an act of treason. Possibly, we shall all be indicted. What do you think so far? Like it? You're going to like it. Over the weekend, the New York Times revealed that a seemingly harmless joke rouses the suspicions of the FBI. So apparently did a retired British spy's idiotic dossier, which claimed Trump was involved in some kind of gynecological exuberance in a Russian honey trap. Such claims led the Bureau to open a secret investigation into the Trump campaign and his early presidency. The FBI has quietly been investigating him for a couple of years now and will, I have no doubt, insist that he has been colluding with the Russians on some dark and clearly illegal dealings. Though the Times was careful to add that the special counsel Robert Mueller III has as yet found no collusion by President Trump. As an aside, collusion is not a crime. The only time collusion is a crime is when you're involved in antitrust law. Thus, Donald Trump is the first presidential candidate ever to be suspected of treason in American history. He may be the first to be indicted, and possibly he will be hanged. Among his high crimes and misdemeanors is an amusing joke and a completely fictional account of his deportment in a Moscow hotel with Russian ladies of delight years ago. Dreamed up, I should add, by a man who sounds like a pathological liar. The evidence? Well, he was hired by the Clintons. It might sound laughable at this stage, but I believe it is the course that will be followed by the Democrats in running down a president who has brought so many jobs and so much renewed vigor to the American economy. Forget the old saw of the Clinton era that it's the economy, stupid. Critics such as Newt Gingrich say the reckless pursuit of Donald Trump sounds like America is heading down the path of a banana republic, but who is to stop the president's opponents? Meanwhile, the whereabouts of Hillary's 30,000 emails remain a mystery. Hold it, as an aside, I'd be willing to bet the NSA has every freaking one of them. Just an idea. But do you notice how both parties, nobody, and I mean nobody, will approach the NSA to ask them or subpoena them? Just a thought. The misdeeds of the Clinton Foundation are forgotten. And by the way, what about the hundreds of thousands of dollars hauled in from Russia by ex-President Bill Clinton, he of the Churchillian oratory? Democrats colluding with Russians is an old story. Though the Russians have usually been communists, and I guess you'd have to expect Democrats to collude with communists in years gone by. But Republicans colluding with Russians? Even only rumors of Republicans colluding with Russians, with special counsels finding no evidence of it, is a serious matter. So watch the new Democratic Congress take last week's New York Times story as their blueprint for investigating President Trump. I cannot wait to see what they make of the Moscow Hotel episode. And will the Moscow ladies be supported by the America's Me Too movement? You know, as I say, Democrats have colluded with Russian communists for years. For years. There was the Democrats' love affair with the communist agent Alger Hiss, beginning with Dean Acheson's boast, "I do not intend to turn my back on Alger Hiss." More recently, there was Senator Edward Kennedy sending his emissary, former Senator John Tooney, to Moscow to, I guess the word is collude, with the head of the KGB about how they might cooperate with each other to beat President Ronald Reagan in 1984. It has all been documented by the historian Paul Kengor in his stupendous book, The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism. He even reports on where you might find the Soviet documents. He got them in Moscow. More recently, a Democratic president was caught on a live mic telling Russian President Dmitry Medvedev that, "I'll have more flexibility after the election to handle contentious issues such as missile defense. If this is not collusion..." But President Obama was not telling a joke. He was serious. In America today, jokes and ribaldry are what attracts the suspicions of the FBI. My, oh my, we live in frivolous times. What do you think about that? Oh, what else we got here?
Shelby Gallagher here, letting you know the second book in my book series, A Great State, is set for release on October 28th. Book 2, The Aftermath, is a continuation of the story from The Divide, where our main character, Julie, a single mother, preps for a collapse. Her story is one of overcoming, strength, and prepping as her community crumbles around her. Sound like recent headlines? Book 2 continues the story with tragic details of what life will be like for those who don't prepare. Pre-order your copy now at my website, agreatstate.com.
Ah, yes. Now, here's some commentary. CNS News, and this is very interesting. I want you to think about it, especially for those of you that are not living in the tyranny state of Illinois, which is about to be dragged even farther to the left. And yes, before next week, that goof that was elected Governor Pritzker, they're getting ready to clamp down on firearms ownership. So I'm planning either, I'd like to go tomorrow and get another firearm. And no, I'm not registering my firearms with the state. You think I got firearms? Good luck. Come and find them. Because they won't be on my property. Have a nice day finding it. So this is a commentary from Twyla Brace. If you don't know who Twyla Brace is, she's an RN. And she's been called one of the 100 most powerful people in healthcare. And she's one of Minnesota's 100 most influential healthcare leaders. She is president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. It's a national, patient-centered health freedom organization that exists to protect healthcare choices, individualized patient care, and medical and genetic privacy rights. This is what she wrote, and I think it's interesting. I think any people who, shall we say, are employed by some state legislators who are listening to this would be good. And this is good for all 50 states, by the way. So 2 years ago, our organization called on states opposing Obamacare. Did I say 2 weeks ago? It is 2 weeks ago. Okay, not 2 years. 2 weeks ago, our organization called on states opposing Obamacare to take the judge's ruling and run with it. The ACA was ruled invalid, giving states an easy opportunity to break free. We asked states to move forward with laws and regulations not compliant with the ACA, to ask insurers to offer the affordable major medical catastrophic policies now prohibited by the ACA, and to reopen high-risk pools for people with uninsurable pre-existing conditions. Judge Reed O'Connor rightly ruled the mandate unconstitutional and the Affordable Care Act therefore invalid. The penalty tax for failing to comply with the coverage mandate is considered essential to the law and the basis of its constitutionality. Since the tax no longer acts as a tax by dropping to zero on January 1, he made the mandate unconstitutional. And because the mandate is inseparable from the rest of the law, the entire Affordable Care Act must be struck. Now, the judge's ruling is an opportunity for states to remember their constitutional 10th Amendment rights and to take steps to restore affordable health insurance options to the residents. It's an opportunity to push the public debate in the right direction, away from the ACA's socialized medicine system and back to state and individual freedom. Last week, the judge put his ruling on hold pending appeal, but that doesn't mean Republicans should not use their 10th Amendment rights to act. The law has always been unconstitutional. Republican-led states should seize the day and not sit in silence. Now, I agree with that. Now, do I believe that the insurance companies have overpriced our healthcare policies in the past? Yes. But they're doing it now, even on the ACA, and no one has the wherewithal or the intestinal fortitude to push back and say, no, you can't do it. Do I like the idea of pre-existing conditions? No, but pre-existing conditions is in fact reality. Does that mean they shouldn't be insured? No, they should be insured. They should be able to get it, and they shouldn't have to go broke with it trying to get in medical insurance. After all, if you're one of those people, wouldn't you want to have that opportunity to purchase medical insurance without going bankrupt for it? My opinion is, you know what? Don't raise the rates. I'm sick and tired. You know, and people say, well, the insurance companies are, you know, such a, their margins are so, you know, so razor thin and close. You know what? I don't care. I'm sick and tired of all the nonsense. And it's at the point now, I don't think anyone knows what the real truth is. The insurance companies say, well, the health care costs are so high, we got to, and the hospitals say, well, we got to charge all this because, you know, of malpractice insurance. You know, it's just a never-ending circle. It goes on and on and on and on and on. It never ends, and nobody wants to do anything about it. Now, do I think Obamacare is the answer? No, I do not. In fact, I'm still kind of stuck on what Obama said during his speech. If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. Oh, I'm sorry. Did he lie? Yes. And of course, it was glossed over. Just glossed over by the mainstream media. You know, some people call him Chicago Jesus. And I think Rush penned that term, that little moniker for him. All right. Okay. Here we go. Where is this from? Front Page Magazine. Another good conservative one. This is by David Horowitz. Do you guys like Horowitz? I do. He said, every progressive is a totalitarian screaming to get out. I love it. Joseph Klein wrote this one. He says, old Russian collusion stories recycled to unfairly attack Trump. It's much ado about nothing. The Washington Post, should be compost, really, reported this past weekend that President Trump wanted to keep his own private conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin truly private. Shocking. President Trump has gone to extraordinary lengths to conceal details about his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin, wrote the Washington Post national security reporter Greg Miller, including on at least one occasion taking possession of the notes of his own interpreter and instructing the linguist not to discuss what had transpired with other administration officials. A former Deputy Secretary of State during the Clinton administration, who is now at the Brookings Institution, called such secrecy surrounding President Trump's conversations with President Putin outrageous, according to the Washington Compost article. Washington Compost reporter Greg Miller, also the author of The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy, has an obvious agenda in recycling old news, that President Trump wanted time alone with President Putin and took precautions to make sure that nothing said during their private meetings would leak. Now, as Democrats in the House prepare to begin their relentless investigations of the Trump administration, Miller wants his story to help reignite the anti-Trump narrative that President Trump is in cahoots with Vladimir Putin. Shall we take a quick look at what is it that Obama said? Oh, yeah, after the election, I'll have more freedom. Yeah, but that's not collusion. No, no, no. And if that wasn't an open mic there, no one would have heard it. But that's okay. We're worried about something that doesn't even exist. So, we will be holding hearings on the mysteries surrounding Trump's bizarre relationship with Putin, promised House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel, a Democrat from New York. Now, Representative Engel is so obsessed with President Trump that he has decided to replace his committee's terrorism subcommittee with a panel focusing on investigating matters related to President Trump. It says something about the skewed sense of priorities of the new Democratic majority in the House that the serious threat of terrorism against American citizens is no longer worthy of special attention by a subcommittee. Instead, they want to create yet another redundant panel to go after President Trump. Although President Trump said that the claims in Miller's articles are ridiculous, so what if he claims to turn out to be true? President Trump's critics need to take a deep breath and read upon the Constitution, which vests the executive power individually in the President of the United States. The Founding Fathers rejected the notion of a plurality of rule in the executive branch. Decision, activity, secrecy, and dispatch will generally characterize the proceedings of one man in a much more eminent degree than the proceedings of any greater number, and in proportion as the number is increased. These qualities will be diminished, wrote Alexander Hamilton in Federalist No. 70. Hamilton warned against vesting executive powers ostensibly in one man, subject in whole or in part to the control and cooperation of others in the capacity of counselors to him. Now, the President of the United States, as the nation's single chief executive under Article 2 of the Constitution, would have no obligation to invite his Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, or anyone else in his administration to attend his own private discussions with his foreign leader counterparts. He also has no obligation to share any of those contents of such discussions with members of his administration or have his translator retain any copies of transcripts or notes for disclosure to third parties. After the deep state leaks from President Trump's private meetings and telephone conversations intended to embarrass the president that occurred earlier in his term, President Trump has good reason to keep his own counsel. Congress would be violating the separation of powers between the executive and legislative branches if, as is most likely, the Democrats in the House were to demand testimony or documents of the president's translator pertaining to his private meetings with President Putin. Executive privilege protects the confidentiality of the president's private conversations from disclosure to the legislative branch. While there is no absolute right of executive privilege, the Supreme Court has declared that military or diplomatic secrets are amongst the areas of Article II duties the courts have traditionally shown the utmost deference to presidential responsibilities. Gamal Hilal, an Arabic interpreter and senior advisor to four presidents and seven secretaries of state, said he knew of no precedent in which Congress had ordered a translator to appear before it. It would be a horrible precedent if a president wasn't free to talk one-on-one with the head of state, Hilal said. He uses the translator to communicate because he cannot do so in a certain language. The principal uses the interpreter to communicate. Therefore, the interpreter is an extension of the principal. Sometimes you prepare the notes at the request of the president. Once you have the notes, you give them to the president and he does what he wants with it. It is not up to the interpreter to reveal what he says. Only the principal has that right and privilege to control the fate of those notes. If President Trump and Putin did concoct something favorable to Russia during any of their private meetings, President Trump has not exactly fulfilled his end of the bargain. The president's decision to impose tough sanctions against Russian individuals and organizations, his expulsion of Russian diplomats, his attempts to entice Western European countries away from overdependence on Russian energy, his call for a sharply increased spending on the military, and his decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine are certainly not the actions of a Russian agent. When you actually look at the substance of what his administration has done, not the rhetoric, but the substance, this administration has been much tougher on Russia than in any post-Cold War era. And that's what Daniel Vadvich, who's a senior fellow of the Atlantic Council, said. In short, Greg Miller may have intended his Washington Compost article with a blaring headline, "Trump has concealed details of his face-to-face encounters with Putin from senior officials in the administration," to stir up a hornet's nest. Instead, he's only served to make a mountain out of a molehill. Miller's article follows on the heels of a New York Times story last Saturday that the FBI had opened a counter-intel investigation into whether President Trump had been working on behalf of Russia against American interests. The FBI investigation began in the days immediately following the president's firing of James Comey as FBI director. Now, while revelation of the full scope of the investigation itself, if true, is newsworthy, the examples of allegedly suspicious behavior of President Trump cited in the New York Times article are recycled old news. It was a lame attempt to reignite the Russian collusion narrative, which, by the way, it is not a crime. And CNN is also seeking to keep the FBI's Trump investigative story alive, now citing portions of transcripts of two FBI officials' closed-door congressional interviews that CNN had obtained. CNN quoted James Baker, then FBI General Counsel, as having said that the FBI was investigating a whole range of possibilities involving the relationship between Trump and the Russians, including the theoretical possibility that President Trump was acting at the behest of and somehow following directions, somehow executing their will. I'm sorry, I can't stand it. It's too stupid. When President Trump was asked Saturday night by Jeanine Pirro, that's Judge Jeanine, on her Fox News show whether he now or ever has worked for Russia, the president scornfully replied, I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked. Referring to the New York Times article, he added, if you read the article, you see that they found absolutely nothing. On Monday, the president came out swinging, flatly denying that he has worked for Russia. I never worked for Russia. And you know that answer better than anybody, he responded to a reporter's question. He said the FBI officials who launched the investigation were known scoundrels and dirty cops. More than 1.5 years after the FBI investigation of a theoretical possibility was reportedly launched and then carried forward by the special counsel Robert Mueller, the New York Times and CNN chose to go back to the future. One would think that they had unearthed significant new evidence of President Trump's wrongdoing that they would move the Russian agent story from the realm of theoretical possibility to the realm of hard facts, but they didn't. The hate Trump media's nonstop vitriol against the president has become tiresome. President Trump has every right to hit back hard at the kind of fake media reports we see too often by the likes of the Washington Compost, the New York Slime, and the Clinton News Network. Oh, by the way, if you're worried about Joseph Klein, he is a Harvard-trained lawyer and is the author of the book Global Deception, the UN's Stealth Assault on America's Freedom, and Lethal Engagement, Barack Hussein Obama, the United States, and Radical Islam. Those are the books. Well, I'd like to tell you who these people are when possible. I do. Oh, what have we got coming out of California this time? You want to hear about that? And, of course, coming up, we'll also have our weekly social justice alert where we can see all about these fools, what they're up to next, the social justice warriors. You guys, let me see how much time we've got here. Yeah, I think we should do it. Out of California, California's Council of American Islamic Relations collaborator, Judge Deborah Barnes, and her endless quest to free convicted terrorist Hamid Hayat. Where do we find this? Front page again. I do. I like front page. You should check them out. They're pretty good stuff. Last Friday in Sacramento, U.S. Magistrate Judge Deborah Barnes submitted a 116-page recommendation that the conviction of Hamid Hayat be vacated. It was Barnes' latest attempt to free Hayat, convicted in 2006 of providing support to terrorists in the first major prosecution of terrorism after the 9/11 attacks. Barnes' ruling charges that Hayat's lawyer, Wasma Mojadidi, a former president of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Sacramento, put on an ineffective defense for Hayat. After Friday's ruling, Mojadidi told the Sacramento Bee, I'm elated to hear that he could be freed soon after unjustly spending so many years in prison. Well, if it's so unjust, maybe you should have done a better job representing him. Here, I just had this thought. I want to share it with you. Perhaps lawyers, when they do criminal defense, should in some way have to share their client's punishment if their client's convicted. Therefore, wouldn't that kind of make it a lot easier or provide them more motivation to do a better job? I'm just throwing it out there. Now, Sacramento Care Executive Director Basim Alkara said in a statement that Hayat did not receive a fair trial, and Dennis Reardon of Hayat's defense team opined that Barnes' ruling was, effectively a finding of actual innocence. The courts have established otherwise, and Friday's ruling was the latest episode in a long campaign of strange judicial rulings and bizarre courtroom capers. Now, CARE and the Muslim Legal Fund of America judge-shopped Deborah Barnes, a relative newcomer to California's Eastern District. Barnes has spent much of her career in the office of California's Attorney General, where she worked on environmental issues. In effect, the judge would become a member of Hayat's legal team. Barnes' June 7, 2017 order raised serious questions concerning the competency of the defense. That was the very defense Hayat's team wanted, led by CARE's rising star, Wasma Mojadidi. After she failed, the judge wasn't done, and in January 2018, Barnes ordered an evidentiary hearing on the Hyatt case that proved revealing on several fronts. Kerr's Basim Alkara again cited concerns that Hyatt did not receive a fair trial. I know, stick with me. The Muslim Legal Fund of America Executive Director Khalil Meek argued that Hyatt was essentially convicted for possessing a prayer written on paper that asked God for protection. Dennis Reardon went on record that this motion to vacate Hyatt's conviction is currently the best vehicle for exposing the harmful effects of anti-Muslim bias in American courtrooms. As the facts showed, it was more about Muslim hatred of Americans. Hamid Hayat was convicted in 2006 for aiding terrorists by lying to the FBI. In 2013, oh, my Lord, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld his conviction, and in 2014, U.S. District Judge Garland Burrell denied Hyatt's motion for summary judgment to vacate his conviction. Following that ruling, former U.S. Attorney McGregor Scott, who headed Hyatt's 2006 prosecution, told reporters, "It was a righteous prosecution and a just result." In 2007, federal authorities argued against a new trial for Hyatt, as their legal brief noted. Hyatt claimed that jihad was the duty of all Muslims, his motive for attending the terrorist training camp. In recorded interviews, Hyatt gleefully stated he was so pleased that jihadis had cut Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl into pieces. Hyatt said Pearl was Jewish and that as a result of this good job, now they can't send one Jewish person to Pakistan. In January 2018, Wasma Mojadidi denied that she was to blame for losing the case. Hyatt's attorneys wanted family members to testify by video from Pakistan. For prosecutors, that raised questions about how the witnesses would be sworn in and the consequences if they lied. Judge Barnes wondered if they could take an oath under Pakistani law, which is not valid in the United States and which Barnes did not swear to uphold. That brought more objections from prosecutors, but as Barnes explained, the parties are free to argue the effect of the oath and any penalties for false testimony in their briefing after all the evidence is heard. The Barnes scheduled two nights of testimony for the Pakistani witnesses using an encrypted federal court video conferencing system. All the witnesses testified that Hamid Hayat was a great guy and could not have attended a terrorist training camp. The hearing did not render a new trial or vacate Hayat's conviction, but Deborah Barnes was not about to give up. Her 116-page recommendation now goes before Judge Garland Burrell, who has already denied the motion to vacate. Original prosecutor McGregor Scott, once again the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of California, told reporters Mr. Hyatt received effective representation at trial and that his conviction by a jury, subsequently affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, is completely valid. Even so, an appeal might settle some issues. Now, Judge Deborah Barnes' performance review of Wasma Mojadidi, who denies she was incompetent, supposedly establishes the innocence of Hamid Hayat. The judge was willing to allow Islam-based Pakistani law to intrude in an American courtroom, and she authorized video testimony from Pakistan with no consequences for falsification. Some higher court needs to determine how all that conforms with U.S. law, the Constitution of the United States, and whether it serves the interests of justice. A performance review for Deborah Barnes might also be in order. Any observer could be forgiven for believing the judge should be removed from the case or relieved of her job. Meanwhile, Hamid Hayat is due for release in May of 2026. There you go. There you have it. All right. We've got a few minutes here. Let's see what we've got rolling. Is it that time again? Is it? It might be. I know, you all wait for this. Yeah, I know, you guys love this stuff, so do I. Let's do it. Ready? And it's time for our social justice segment from Breitbart. Oh, yes. Shall we start? Where shall we start? Oh, there's so many to choose from. Where do we go? The BBC announces diversity season to celebrate history of multicultural Britain. Yeah, that's really working out well for them. BBC4 has announced it will air a number of new shows focused on the hidden history of ethnic minorities in the UK next month as part of a season which will celebrate British diversity. Yeah, that's not really working out for them. What else we have? White comic is banned from comedy nights due to cultural appropriation, dreadlocks. White comedian Zach Poitras was banned from participating in two nights of comedy events in the Canadian city of Montreal after organizers claimed his dreadlock hairstyle was inappropriate. Oh, for the love of... never mind. The DNC ditches Women's March as controversy continues to swirl around leadership. The Women's March is still scheduled to take place on Saturday on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. But the anti-President Donald Trump event has been losing the support of sponsors, including the Democratic National Committee, following charges its leaders are anti-Semitic. Which brings me to another... you know what? I don't understand why anybody of the Jewish faith would be aligning themselves with the Democrats, who have aligned themselves with leaders in their party who are anti-Semitic. I don't understand that. If someone could explain it to me, I would appreciate it. I would, because I don't get it. It's like, what? Why would you even do that? What else we have here? BYU, Brigham Young University, apologizes after posting photo of white students dressed as tacos. Yes, BYU apologized this week after it faced criticism for an Instagram post featuring two white students dressed as tacos. What I've got to say. This is interesting, this one. Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin abandoned Patreon in protest of censorship. Best-selling author Dr. Jordan Peterson and Rubin Report host Dave Rubin have left Patreon in protest of the funding platform's censorship, losing up to $100,000 of monthly income between the two of them in the process. You know, myself, I had CRN on Patreon. If some of you listeners actually donated to the show to help fund me, I do appreciate it. Which reminds me, come on guys, $2 a month, $2 a month, that's what I'm asking for all the listeners, $2 a month to help out. That's all I'm asking, $2. If you want to give more, great. Some of you have, but I think I've only got 5 people is actually throwing a few bucks in per month. I'm asking for $2 per listener. Come on, guys. $2 per listener. And you can do it right there on the Podbean app. Support me. Come on. And don't forget to rate the show, too. I need you guys to rate the show, if you would. How much time I got left here? Oh, I got a little... not much. Stanford student newspaper admits progressive bias and leaked documents. Gillette toxic masculinity commercial set to break into the most disliked YouTube videos list. Roku caves, blacklist InfoWars following left-wing demand. Oh, for the love of God, we just can't... the words hurt. What else we have here? UNC Chapel Hill chancellor removes Confederate pedestal before abruptly resigning. Then they should put it back up there. I'm so sick of these people. All right, now I'm off time. I want to say thanks for listening in. I do appreciate it. Hey, consider throwing it. I'm asking for $2 a month. You could throw more in if you want. I'm asking for $2 a month. $2 a month. Come on, give me a hand. And then rate the show. And don't forget, we've got Podcasting 2.0. I've got Mark's show. And we've got our new show, Conservative Underground. Hope you all listen to it. And don't forget, we're all on KYAH, 540 AM. Feel free to listen to that. And until the next time, I'm John Jeffers here at the Jeffers Brief on Contra Radio Network and KYAH, saying thank you for listening, and we hope to Hey, stick with us. I think you'll like it.